Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This first segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Colleen Wheatley from About Face. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with About Face.
Sure. Well, I guess this year, the most exciting thing, it was actually our 10-year anniversary of our Camp Trailblazers program, which was one of our biggest programs. So that's our camp program for campers age 10 to 18 who have a facial difference. So this year was the first year that we were able to actually host two of our camps in the summer. We had a camp out at Brigadoon Village, which is in Nova Scotia, in August, as well as our Ontario camp was at Easter Seals Camp Woodeden in London. So that was really exciting that we were actually able to have camp instead of in September. It was warm, there was lots of swimming, and we were able to extend it. So it was actually 5 days instead of just 4 days. So that was really exciting.
So can you tell me a little bit about the social impact for someone with a facial difference that this camp might have?
Sure. Well, one of the things is that really having a facial difference or having any sort of physical or visual difference, it does have an impact on how people react to you. And, you know, that's just human nature. We're kind of taught from a young age through fairy tales, through, you know, things that we see on the media, in TV and books. We're kind of taught to be cautious of people who look different. Which often makes people curious, and it can lead to, you know, kind of questions, or more often is actually avoidance, which is a little trickier to kind of name and notice, but it would be more just avoidance of, I'm not sure how to react, so I'm going to avoid you, which then really just kind of turns into exclusion, especially with children. So Camp Trailblazers, it's really an opportunity. Camp is a great time, camp for anyone. It's a really great time for kids to develop resilience. It's a great time for them to challenge themselves in a safe place. So, you know, they can get out of their comfort zone. They can do that challenge. They can say, okay, I want to make it to the top of the high ropes course. I want to go to the top of the rock wall. And if they reach their goal, that's fantastic. They're surrounded by people who will celebrate that. If they only make it halfway up, that's okay, because they're in an environment where the feedback they get is, that's okay, you know, you didn't reach your goal this time, but we're going to support you to get a little closer to that goal. So that's one of the really important things about camp, is really developing that resilience, which then kind of will be useful in life later on. Because, you know, I can say for myself, you know, I don't reach all of my goals at the first attempt. I'm not always successful at the first try. Sometimes I need to try a few more times. And so to reach those goals, you need to be able to make those multiple attempts. The big thing about camp is, for some of our campers, it's the first time that they're actually able to meet somebody else who has a facial difference, which can be a pretty powerful and impactful moment to know, you know, I'm not alone. There's other people who know what I'm going through. It's really great for connecting, even just for life experience, you know, to know that there's somebody else who's gone through that surgery that you're going to go through, and you can ask those questions. To be able to make friends where you don't have to explain, you know, I'll speak from my personal self, but, you know, to say, hi, I'm Colleen, how are you? Or they don't have to say, okay, I'm making a new friend, hi, I'm Colleen, and by the way, I have a birthmark. You might be curious about that, and I'll explain it to you. Where they can just go to camp and they can just be kids and they can have fun. So we like to do a combination of the traditional camp activities, but also do a couple workshops that kind of focus on maybe some of the other aspects or challenges that you might have if you have a facial difference. So we do things, you know, little activities that involve making eye contact. And so it's a little game that you can have fun with at camp. But also really what we're doing is we're practicing so that it gets easier for those campers when they go back to their daily life to make contact when they eye contact when they meet new people, to shake somebody's hand and say their name and feel comfortable. We do things like practice talking about your facial difference, because a lot of us do get asked about our facial difference. And to be able to say something and to be able to explain it and use your own words is really important. And so the more that you practice, the easier it gets. So we do lots of activities like that. And also some other things, you know, talking about bullying, talking about surgery, schools, relationships, all of those sort of things. And just to be able to do that with peers in a safe and supportive, comfortable environment, but also one that's pretty fun as well.
So in your time with the camp at About Face, what's been the greatest success moment that you've seen?
You know what, I don't think I can really pick one. I will say, you know, this year, there have been a few. So, you know, I think one this year, you know, I have a camper who I've known for a couple of years, and she tends to be quite shy, and really almost only seems to engage with the leaders or the other volunteers. And this year was one of the first times when we did our little activity, finger jousting, which is just, like I said, an activity where you're making eye contact. And to see her giggling and laughing and making eye contact with her peers is something I haven't seen in the past three years. So that was really cool, you know, and some of those moments. Also having campers this year, all of the campers were asked to create a goal, and that could be swimming to the raft. Or it could be getting to the top of high ropes. Some of the campers also made goals. You know, a really great example was, you know, I get really nervous when I go, when I'm out shopping, when I'm at the mall. I get really nervous if I have to go ask for assistance from like a sales clerk or the cashier. And so while we weren't able to really address that at camp, we kind of broke it down to what can we do while we're at camp. And so we broke it down to, okay, so one of the things is talking to strangers can be kind of intimidating. So the goal was, okay, I'm going to talk to five strangers while I'm at camp, you know, or I'm going to talk to one new person every day. So we were able to practice that. So that was kind of a small moment, but it was great to you know, kind of realize that what we are doing at camp can really overlap, and it can have a positive impact on life outside of camp. I'd say another kind of win, I guess, in my head is sometimes some of us are self-conscious about our facial difference, and if we can kind of, you know, distract folks, you know, maybe cover it up, then sometimes that's a little easier, and I think that's a normal and okay coping mechanism. And so one of our campers, who I've known for quite a few years, she can be self-conscious about her ear. It's not fully formed, which is a form of microtia, and that's part of her facial difference. So, you know, she generally keeps it covered up, you know, has her hair tied back, maybe in a low ponytail, so it's kind of covering her ears. And it's something that she's talked about quite a few times at camp. And so I think last year she kind of pulled it half back so you could kind of see her ears. And then this year she took a photo with her hair pulled back in a high ponytail, holding her hair back so you could see her ear, which was a pretty big moment for her. And now to see her outside of camp, you know, she was involved in another, you know, they were taking photos and doing some filming. And somebody asked, you know, would you be able to show us your ear? And knowing her, I was like, oh, that's something that she might not be comfortable doing. And she had no hesitation pulling her hair back and showing her ear, which is something I know that she wouldn't have done a year ago. And she wouldn't have done if she had felt safe and comfortable to do that and take that photo at camp. So that was a really cool moment to be kind of a part of on the edge.
So if you could send any one message about the need for acceptance and equality among people of all types of differences, what would you say?
Oh, I am going to wish I was more articulate after this. I guess really recognizing, I think sometimes we think that, society and culture, we have made some changes, and we are a little more accepting and aware of differences. And I think sometimes people think that means that, we've succeeded. People are no longer judged on the way they look. And while I wish that was true, I think the reality is that it's not. I mean, and I think that's just us being human. I know I'll judge people based on their appearance because that's the first thing that you're able to see and observe before you get to know that person. So I think still being able to recognize that and be aware of it, there's always that quote of saying, if you're not part of the solution, then you're part of the problem. So I think really recognizing that we still do have work to do and that you can still do it within yourself, recognize when you meet other people, what are you doing? How can you, be respectful and welcoming and just kind of acknowledging that, being honest with yourself and being honest with others and, learning more about people and, being open-minded, sometimes people I've been told, you're beautiful on the inside. I think that I'm beautiful on the outside as well, even though I might look a little different. And so I think really, not just accepting differences, but really embracing and celebrating them. And, I think we are getting better at it, but I think there's a little bit of work for us to do, and we can do it together.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
No problem.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Ontario Students Against Impaired Driving is an anti-impaired driving initiative that strives to promote smart, healthy choices through education and public awareness to prevent tragedies caused by impaired and distracted driving. OSAID is about teens helping teens to consider safe alternatives and new perspectives to the perceived norms about alcohol, illicit drugs, and dangerous driving. For more information or to join the team, visit www.osaid.org.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Colleen Wheatley from About Face. In this segment of our show, we'll be hearing about what it's like for someone coming out of the correction system who might be facing mental illness, what it's like for them to readjust to society. Here to help me with that is our old friend, Pastor Riley McLaren.
Well, it's good to be here, Cam.
So, can you tell me a little bit about some of your observations of what it's like for these men coming out?
Yeah, well, for one, I would say that as a chaplain out of St. Leonard's House and witnessing men coming out of prison, they have various challenges for reintegration if they've done 10, 20, 30, even 40 years in prison. And many of them are institutionalization and a wide array of other kinds of challenges. But particularly, we've noticed over the last number of years that mental health has been a huge challenge. Where, for example, we went from needing to give medication to maybe a few guys in the house, in our halfway house, to now needing to have a full dockets of medication. And they're usually psychotropic meds, mood stabilizers, a wide array of different types of medications to do with mental health. So it's on the rise, and we'll have to ask the question why. You know, wonder why all of a sudden is there so many people that are coming through the correctional institutions, Correctional Service of Canada, with mental health challenges.
Is there a possibility that their time within the system has left them with a type of trauma, type of residual stress?
Oh, for sure. For one, depending on their crime, there is the potential that if someone is suffering from mental health, they may have been untreated and committed a crime as a result. But also, once you're in the correctional institution, if you have a diagnosed mental illness, usually that mental illness is exacerbated, or you're taken advantage of while you're inside the prisons, you're used, so your mental health is made a lot worse. For those that are inside that develop some kind of mental health concern, post-traumatic stress would be one example, where fights and extortion and all sorts of different pressures that exist within the institution will cause someone to really degrade from a mental standpoint.
So, in your work, you're helping these men readjust to society. If you see someone with mental illness, what sorts of supports do you point them in the direction of?
Well, it's great that we have local CMHA as a key resource. We have street health as well. There are nurses, practitioners, and nurses that are willing to help, and doctors and psychologists and psychiatrists that are in the community. But the challenge is, once a gentleman is released, he needs to be able to get all his ducks in a row in terms of what are his diagnosis and what are the medications he needs to take. Because sometimes when they're released, we have very little information, and it's pretty frustrating when somebody gets a new psychiatrist and all of a sudden they're prescribed all sorts of new medications when they took a bunch of old medications before, and it takes a while to get used to them. So for me, the resources I provide is just a stable person, a friend who can walk with them, can journey with them through this transition that can be very, very difficult and very scary to come back into the community. And I don't want to say, because these people have offended against society in some way, that we coddle them or just say, oh, it's not that bad, it's okay. But we're actually there to help them contribute to society, to give back. But that means getting them stable. And that is a whole process in and of itself that is challenging. So our staff, our caseworkers, our executive directors, our volunteers, all are there to help socialize, to help counsel, to help balance, and advocate for them in front of even their own psychiatrists. I've sat in on psychiatrist appointments with many of the guys because they're not sure they can communicate what they need to in terms of their symptoms. And if a psychiatrist just decides to prescribe them new medication, it could throw them off so badly that they end up breaking their parole and going back to prison, which I've seen happen many, many times.
So you're thinking it should be along the lines of taking the time, taking the care for these individuals, and not medicine on the assembly line, if you will.
Yeah, oftentimes medication is just thrown at people. I'm a huge advocate for medication. I take medication. I have anxiety and depression, and I'm not afraid to say that. And I want to release the stigmas of mental health. And we did a series at our church about mental health, and that was a really key thing to say, hey, don't be afraid to talk about it. We want to develop a safe place to discuss it. But for these guys in particular, because of their stigma of their crime and then the stigma of mental illness, there's a lot of reasons for them to want to hide and feel that shame. And we want to be able to love them through that experience and help them know that there are options, and that even when a psychiatrist maybe isn't paying the attention that the person needs, that we would step in and help and offer that advocacy.
So, in your time doing this work, have you seen any success moments that stand out for you?
Yes, I have. There are, some. It's really difficult to see some particular conditions like schizophrenia or any kind of personality disorder. But I can think of many times where we found the right medication, the right combination of medications with the psychiatrists and meeting with psychologists, and the person is stabilized, and then they get a job, and they're able to work at a job and get a sense of fulfillment and dignity from that work, and then they're even potentially able to get into a new relationship. And I've seen this happen time and time and time again, but it takes a lot of patience, and it's slow oftentimes. We want to hurry that process. It's hard to give personal examples because, you know, I don't want to break the confidentiality of the guys, but I have spent enough time to know that there is something special going on. Maybe at this time, just pause.
Yep.
Well, I can think of one gentleman in particular who has a bipolar disorder, which is something that unfortunately is really common. He's a lifer, meaning that he's doing life and in prison for murder. And he went in when he was 19 years old. And as an attempt to get parole, he was revoked because of drug addiction and a number of other things. Ended up having to come back to prison time and time and time again. So he spent much more time in prison than he needed to be. But finally, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, as well as ADHD, and this began the process of treating it. And when he was released to Windsor, to the halfway house, we were able to work through what his challenges are, and then be able to set up a plan to be able to get him the help that he needs and just love him and serve him. And so recently I just had him speak. He just did a speaking event at one of my chaplaincy fundraisers, and he was able to share about how through the challenges of mental health, he's been able to overcome a lot and begin the process of being a productive member of society. And after doing 35 years in prison, it's really amazing that someone would be able to make such a big turnaround in their life when they have so many things working against them and they haven't been really given a shake at life and they made some mistakes early on. So it does give me great pleasure to see that kind of restoration.
So if you could send any one message about the importance of acceptance of all people mm-hmm. back into society, mental illness or not, what would you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I can't think of just one thing. I could say a lot of things, Cam. But I would say that if you see someone on the street that's struggling with mental health, I know it can be a little bit scary at first, but you know, that's a person. There's a person in there, and they're battling with something that maybe we don't understand, but they are a person that needs love and needs acceptance. And I find that if we just show a little bit of grace, just a little bit of understanding, a little bit of empathy instead of judgment, that can go a long way. Just had a guy that had some mental health challenges just run up to me in Starbucks and start talking to me. And I didn't know him. I don't think he knew me, but he wanted to chat. And I think for one, a person, it would have been very intimidating normally. But I asked him if he had anything, if he had a coffee, and he said no. And I said, well, let me buy you a coffee. And so we went, and hopefully the caffeine didn't do anything negative to him. But I just went over and said, hey, what would you like? And he told me, and so I was able to get a coffee for him. And sit down and talk for a few minutes and hear his story and hear his interests, and then I was on my way. But I think those little steps that show dignity can go a long way. The other thing is, and I hate to sound political in this moment, but it's important that we need to be aware if the government ever cuts any services to mental health, because if services are cut to mental health, I guarantee you the prison population will go up. Because what happens is people suffering from mental health will end up committing crimes in some cases and getting thrown into the prison system with the general population. And that just exacerbates their mental health, and then they're released and they're much worse off than they were before. So it's really important that we maintain mental health services in the community to serve them and care for them, because it makes the community as a whole a better place to live when we're caring for those that are on the fringes that maybe are ignored by society. So I think that's a really big part of the service and being aware of what the government is doing in regards to mental health service.
So how do you go about reaching out to these individuals?
Well, I think it's a responsibility of the entire community to create a space where the stigma isn't there, where there is safety and there's an ability to be vulnerable, and it's knowing that it's okay, you're not a bad person if you struggle with mental health. It's so incredibly common, but no one talks about it because there's so much shame. And to be able to say, as I said, you know, that I struggle with anxiety and depression, and I take medication for it, and I'm not ashamed to admit that, is because I've been a part of a community that has nurtured that safety and that trust. So if you're in your families, in your communities, your church communities, or your faith group, or the university groups that you're a part of, being able to not condemn if someone shares about their mental health. Now, you wouldn't go right out right away and say, hey, you know, get lost or something, but you may treat with suspicion or mistrust, or you may just sort of ignore that person or ignore what their needs are.
Kind of shy away, maybe.
Yeah, shy away. Yeah, just kind of pull back from that relationship. When one day you may struggle with mental health, and I just heard recently that there is a spike even among students, that students are increasingly saying that their mental health is poor. And alcohol use is on the rise. And you have to wonder, what are we not doing to serve people that are suffering from mental health? But I think it comes down to individual relationships and communities, not just the larger services and Big Brother or government kind of thing. It's about the everyday interactions and not being super spiritual about it. If you're a religious person, not just saying, hey, you just need to pray more and then you'll be fine. Getting rid of ideas like that when, yeah, prayer is good, but prayer and medication is better to be able to balance those things. If your concerns with a person are they're unstable and they're very maybe exhausting, they're tiring, they just take a lot of energy out of you, to be able to bring other people into the circle to support them as well instead of you carrying that person all by yourself. Is also important. And of course, being able to refer people to proper medical treatment. So all that to say, nurturing communities of safety and trust where you can share and you're not going to keep it in the dark, you're not going to keep it in the shadows, but you're going to let it out and you're going to be able to talk about it and not be judged.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Cam. Thank you for having me.
Of course. It's just an amazing thing what Riley was saying about compassion and understanding for these people. These men have been through an exceedingly difficult set of circumstances, but the fact is, though they may have made some mistakes along the line, once their debt is paid, and even while they're within the system, we as a society owe it to everyone to make sure they have support and the best chance at a meaningful life. Someone with mental illness going into the system might not have as easy a time getting access to things such as health care, psychiatric treatment. But does this mean because they have stepped outside the lines of the law of what we as a society can easily accept? Does that mean that we have the right to turn our backs on them? Riley's interview answered that question for me in a very meaningful way. The answer is, we certainly do not. They deserve a second chance and healing, at least as much as possible. Might not necessarily be we can solve all the problems for them, but we can be that force that helps them step forward, regardless of their condition. We can help them to build a better life. And that is something of deep meaning. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.